It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
How can we grow food humanely and sustainably, regenerate soils, and reverse climate change? Practical and cutting-edge solutions to these questions and more can be found at the incomparable annual EcoFarm Conference at Asilomar in Pacific Grove, California. If you haven't gone before, you're missing an essential networking and educational hub for ecologically minded farmers, ranchers, and anyone who wants to play a part in growing a more healthy food system. There are over 70 workshops, keynote speakers, farm tours, live entertainment, and organic culinary delights. I try to go to EcoFarm every year, and you'll be glad if you do too. To learn more and to register, visit eco-farm.org. That's eco-farm.org.
What I'm trying to share with people is really the high cost of cheap food. Food should be something that we'd be willing to invest in because it has a high value. You know, we're very well fed in this country, but we're not well nourished. And nourishment is connected to health. So if I can reconnect the idea of agriculture with food, with health, that would accomplish the goal that I had.
Bob Quinn is one of the keynote speakers at EcoFarm, and he's our guest today on Farm to Table Talk. He's a progressive leader in promoting organic and sustainable agriculture throughout the state of Montana, United States, and the world. And after finishing a PhD in plant biochemistry, Bob took over his family's conventional grain and cattle farm in 1978 and started experimenting with organic production in 1986. He used the last chemical application on the farm in 1988 and was 100% certified organic by 1991. As demand for the organics grew, Bob discovered that with time-tested practices like cover cropping and crop rotation, he could produce successful yields without pesticides. He introduced the domestic natural food industry to an ancient Egyptian wheat called Khorasan, which is similar to durum wheat and marketed under his own brand name, Kamet. The brand name helps to preserve the ancient grains and guarantee it is not genetically modified or altered. Bob recently co-authored the book, Grain by Grain, a quest to revive ancient wheat, rural jobs, and healthy food. Bob's challenge to the next generation is to walk through the door that the pioneers of organic opened and reintroduce the world to healthy, flavorful eating. If you look at it as a two-generation project, we're already halfway there. Bob's new challenge to America is to be chemical-free by 43. Bob, I want to start with a question for you. Why did you decide to be an organic farmer?
I'm glad you asked that question, Roger. It's great to be in your program, and I'm honored to have a chance to visit with you and talk about some of my favorite subjects, and organic farming is one of them. And you're right, we are in the minority. There's not much more than 1% in the country. And Montana, however, leads the country in organic wheat production. We have number two in the whole country, right behind California, in the number of organic acres certified. So might not hear much about us, but we're right up there. And a lot of it's small grains and things that are going to the bakers, and some is shipped out of the country, out of state and out of the country. So it's not like we're growing so many fruits and vegetables like you have in California and some other places. But anyway, we're holding our own with what we've got. And I was first interested and curious about organic when I first started meeting farmers and people that I was buying organic grain from in the mid-80s for our markets in California. I had a small cleaning plant and flour mill that we were shipping high-protein wheat to whole grain bakers in California, and they thought our wheat was pretty good, and they wanted organic. And when I found its form, I found some organic farmers, and I was very, very fascinated with their stories of how their soil improves when they went organic and how they could grow their own inputs. They could grow their own fertilizers. They use rotations to break up weed and disease and and insect cycles, and I love plants and I love science, and I just had to try some of my own for my on my own farm and just see what it was like. And so in 1986, we grew our first, planted our first organic experiment. It was 20 acres, and it was a great success. It equaled the non-organic field. It was right next to it in both protein and in yield. And my father was astounded. He'd been putting in tens of thousands of dollars a year in chemicals and fertilizers, and here we could avoid all that expense by growing our own fertilizer. And this was alfalfa that had been worked down, and that was our nutrition for the winter wheat that we planted for our experiment. And after 2 years of experimentation, both of which were very extremely successful, I went cold turkey on the whole farm and never looked back. We've been organic ever since. So it's been over 30 years now. We've been certified organic.
Well, that's kind of interesting. So if you went organic, though, you had to, what, it had to lay fallow for a couple of years because you had to have no chemicals used at all, right, for a certain period before you could actually be certified organic?
Well, we have to have at least 36 months since the last prohibited material was used to be certified organic, but we didn't let it lay fallow. We would grow our normal crops and sell them on the non-organic markets. We stopped fertilizing, we stopped using chemicals, and we started planting cover crops and legumes for soil-building crops, alfalfa and clover and peas and lentils. And we would work those into the soil and feed the soil. And within a year or two, the soil started responding. Within 2 or 3 years, it was completely converted so that our yields were back up to county averages. And we were selling our grains and other seeds for a lot more than our non-organic neighbors and paying a lot less to grow those crops because we didn't have the inputs that they had. So it was a win-win-win situation for us.
Well, that surprises a lot of people. A lot of people that just suspect that you get a lot lower yields and you have other issues and it's very costly. And sometimes you hear them say that, well, I know you can get a little more money for organics, but it still is not as effective. So the common wisdom or conventional wisdom is that in fact you can't match the yields, but you've done that, and you've done it from the start.
Yes, and we're not the only ones, and we were doing it here in Montana, and Rodale Institute has shown over 30 years the same thing in Pennsylvania. So it's a lie that organic means low yields, and it's a lie perpetrated by the chemical companies, and they would have us believe that they have the only solution to feed the world, but actually, organic is the future of agriculture, and it really is the only way we will feed the world in the future.
You know, in fact, I saw somewhere that you had a new campaign slogan or a goal. Was it chemical-free by 43 or something like that?
Yeah.
I don't have my...
Well,
explain that.
Well, I just picked... Well, I'll tell you how it arrived. So in the last 35 years, so in my generation, you would say, we have gone from near zero organic in the grocery stores as a country as a whole to over 6%. We'll probably be pushing 7% this year. That's taken 35 years. And if we look ahead another 35 years, at the current rate, or even less than that now, but in the current rate of growth, we'll be 100% organic in this country. And so I just picked out 43 because it rhymed good, and I figured we're not going to go clear 35 years. That would be up to almost 54, and I couldn't wait that long. I think that we're going to reach a tipping point once we get past, 15% or so organic. We're going to see a big surge and a big growth in organic and a big decline in chemical and poisons used on our ground, and I think 43, chemical-free by 43 is not unreasonable.
Well, maybe not. Let's go back to Montana. Now, it's not surprising to hear about wheat farming in Montana because it's known to be a wheat-producing area. And what makes those upper plains in the west that where you are so much preferred for wheat than, say, you know, the Corn Belt or the South or California What's unique about your area that's so good for wheat?
It doesn't rain here.
Uh-huh.
And so we can't grow corn. We can't grow soybeans. We can't, and we don't have irrigation like California has for fruits and vegetables. And it's way too cold for a lot of fruits, although we can do a certain... I have an experimental orchard, so there's a lot of fruit that we can do, but it's just not done commercially. It doesn't have the tradition of care and development that I think we could see in the future if we would look to some differentiation of our agriculture and try to supply more of what we eat by the region that surrounds our towns and cities throughout the whole country. If we would do that, then you'd see a great diversity of agriculture all over the country rather than just in like the Central Valley, which has all kinds of diversity, and in California, of course, where you have so many choices. We don't have so many choices in Montana, where it's 40 below in the winter and 12 to 14 inches of rainfall during the summer and short seasons. So wheat naturally fit into that cycle, and barley, and those are the became the main crops, besides cattle, of course, grazing on grasslands that were not fit for cultivation, a lot of mountains and river breaks and that sort of thing. And our groundwater isn't fit for irrigation. It's so salty. We're in semi-arid area, and we're very alkaline. The soil is very alkaline, and the groundwater is salty, by and large, to a certain degree. And if you start using it for irrigation, within a few years, you've ruined your soil. So we don't have that choice anyway.
So, Bob, if I got a couple of my listeners in the car and we're coming over the hill and looking at where your land is, what paint a picture for me. What would it look like to us?
Well, we're situated between the Bear Paws Mountains, which is an isolated mountain range in north central Montana. So you'd see the Bear Paws on your left as you're driving out of town, out of Big Sandy, about 12 miles, and we're coming out of Big Sandy. Actually sat in an old river valley that was the Missouri River before the glaciers pushed it south to its current channel, and we're about midway between the current Missouri River and the breaks that surrounds it and the Bear Paw Mountains. So we have some rolling prairie, but we can also see some interesting mountains, and just a few miles away from a great river. It's draining most of Montana.
What's the altitude of your land?
We're at 3,000 feet, and so we have both grasslands and cultivated fields on both sides of the roads that kind of alternate. And you'll see mostly grain fields. There are some lentils grown here, some safflower, some alfalfa, some barley, some peas. And so it's a mixture. But if you're driving past our place, you're going to see mostly wheat and stubble from chem fallow.
Is the ground fairly? Is it fairly flat?
And west of Big Sandy, it's like a tabletop almost. Mm-hmm. Very flat. In our areas, it's more rolling, and because we're between the mountains and the river, as I said. So it's not as quite as flat.
Well, walk us through a wheat season. What do you do? How do you plant wheat? And then kind of maybe we can compare as you walk through the season what would be being done with the conventional at that stage versus what's being done in an organic.
Oh, well, there's not so much different. We're both wanting to seed as early as possible in the spring, which can be anywhere from the 1st of April to the middle of May. But our favorite window is April 15th to May 15th for seeding of spring wheat. Then the crop for the organic farmers, once you seed, then the next step is really the harvest. For the chemical guys, they're going to spray for weeds sometime in June, and they'll put a herbicide on. And that's about the only spraying we do in the neighborhood is with herbicides. There's very few bug. We don't have much bug insect pressure here, so there's very few insecticides that are sprayed. Very rarely is anybody doing that. There's not much fungus with disease, so there's not many fungicides being used either. And then about early August, the spring wheat will be turning, and it'll be harvested and hauled either to town to the big elevators or put on most of it's put into steel bins right on the farmer's place, and then it's sold later on. And that's organic farmers, by and large, are selling throughout the year a little bit at a time, and the chemical guys are usually have a contract, and they sell everything at once. So that's could be, wow. The marketing's a little bit different. Another crop that it's common in this country is winter wheat, which is seeded somewhere between the 10th and the 20th of September, while it's still warm in the fall, and then that'll grow a little bit in the fall, go dormant, go through the winter, and then it comes to life and is greening up as soon as spring breaks, and we're harvesting that at the end of July. Now, the other thing that the difference between the organic farmers and the chemical farmers are that chemical farmers are putting fertilizer on their fields to supplement nitrogen and other minerals that and trying to feed the plant. With an organic farmer, we're focusing on feeding the soil. So we're planting in the spring or the fall legume crops and cover crops that fix nitrogen or add biomass to the soil and feed the biolife of the soil. And that the microbiome of the soil, we could say, feeds the plants.
Wow. Now, you were saying that you go in, say when you're planting in the spring, what kind of shape is the soil in? Is it no-till or minimum till when you're seeding
in
the
spring? We haven't got organic no-till figured out. We've tried the crimping machines that they've used at Rodale in Pennsylvania. We haven't had any luck with that. We've tried a few other approaches, and we still are forced at this time to be tilling minimally. We don't leave the ground completely uncovered, so it's black fallow as we used to have, but it's not no-till like our friends are using Roundup with glyphosate and spraying out the weeds in the summer. In this area, we don't have enough rain to grow a crop every year, by and large. We grow our cash crops every other year. And for the chemical guys are spraying Roundup on their fields every other year on the stubble and then planting into that. So it's no-tilling, as they say. We are raising soil-building crops, and we're tilling those into the soil to feed the soil. We don't till enough. We don't plow. We never plow. We use undercutting implements that cut the roots under the soil, but leave as much trash and material on top of the soil as possible, and mixing some into the soil. So that's how that's the difference between the two systems. One of the differences.
So you were saying earlier that the main difference is just the fact that the conventional farmers, though, in addition to what you're saying, this pre-planting that they have to do, but in the course of growing the crop, they only are applying some sort of herbicide, usually in the middle of the season while it's growing, where you wouldn't, of course, be applying any herbicide at all.
Right.
Well, that's,
and they're putting on chemical fertilizer, and I don't really like to call that conventional.
I think
what's conventional is what we've done for the last 10,000 years.
No, you're right. You're right.
What we've done in the last 60 years, or 70 years, I guess now, is a great American chemical experiment. And we're really starting to see the wheels coming off that bus all over. We're poisoning our groundwater, our surface water. We have Roundup in our rain now. There's all kinds of chronic diseases that are directly linked to pesticide residues, cancer, and all kinds of other things on our food. The poor quality of food is linked to other problems in chronic disease like diabetes and certainly obesity and the problems that brings with it, non-alcoholic fatty liver syndrome, all these kinds of things. And that's why I'm saying that this chemical experiment is going to be coming to an end here in the next decade or two. We have chemical-resistant weeds now, so we're forced to have new chemicals, which are even worse than the old ones. We have all kinds of other problems that are connected to this type of agriculture. And the truth is that it hasn't made the farmers more prosperous. The farmers are less prosperous, and many are going broke now with lower prices and higher costs of inputs. And so we certainly have met the goal of abundant food and plentiful food and cheap food, but it's come at a very, very high cost to societies, to the communities that grow the food, and to the farmers that actually produce it themselves.
Now, Bob, I don't believe there is GMO wheat, is there?
No, there's not.
How come?
But that's not because they haven't tried.
Oh, that's just
that's
what I was going to ask.
The markets, which are mostly overseas, have rejected it and say very clearly to America from China, or not China, but from Japan and from Korea, our biggest Asian customers, that they do not want GMO wheat. And that's been the biggest holdup for it.
So now the other thing I've heard is that with the glyphosate or Roundup type product, there's some cereal crops that use it at the end of the season, too, to dry the crop out for further processing or something like that. Is that right?
Well, it's very commonly used as a desiccant, which means it's sprayed to kill the plant so the plant can dry and be ready for a harvesting machine for legumes, for peas and lentils and chickpeas. All those are directly sprayed. I wouldn't eat any of those that weren't organic, because they've been sprayed, almost all of them, by Roundup right before harvest. And then within a few days, they're combining those. And the residual glyphosate on those is extremely high because they've been so recently sprayed. As you go further north into Canada, more and more wheat was sprayed with Roundup as a desiccant to get it dried and so it could be harvested before the snows came. That's not so common in Montana, or in the Dakotas, and certainly not common further south because it dries out sooner. But for people who have a big weed problem, which chemical guys can have big weed problems too, and later in the season, and some of them have sprayed Roundup late in the season to kill the weeds and dry out the remaining green wheat before harvest. But that's an exception, I would say, rather than the rule in America, for wheat at least.
Bill, I think what you're saying, though, is something that shocks a lot of people, that they're actually using glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, ends up being used like that just at the end of the season. So it could be a product that is technically non-GMO, but they still have what most of the concerns with some of the GMO products were, was that they were kind of Roundup ready. So if they're actually applying
that's
the
right.
glyphosate
that's
to
right.
it, they could be a non-GMO product that actually has had glyphosate directly applied, right?
Right, and for the areas of the Upper Great Plains where they're doing chem fallow, they're spraying glyphosate on those off-year fields two or three times or four times sometimes in a season before they plant the wheat. So the soil has lots of glyphosate in it. Monsanto told us when they were still Monsanto that, don't worry, glyphosate breaks down as soon as it contacts soil or is exposed to sunlight. All that's a lie. It's not true. We're finding it in our soils from the accumulation from rainfall year after year. At very, very low levels, at maybe 20 to 30 parts per billion. It's very low levels, but it's there. And we've never sprayed glyphosate on our farm ever. We were organic before chem fallow became popular and glyphosate became a normal tool for farming. Now a lot of people think you can't farm without it. Well, that's also not true. That's a lie, too. You can certainly farm without it. And it would be a much betterment to the community, to the farmers themselves, and to certainly the people who eat our food if we did farm without it.
You know, Bob, you have a PhD, I believe, in, what is it, plant biology, plant biochemistry?
Yeah, plant biochemistry, yeah.
Well, when you were studying, were they talking about glyphosate back then?
No, that wasn't on the radar where I was at. However, when I was in high school, I went to Virginia Tech, VPI, for a summer between my junior and senior year in a summer science institute, and I studied dicamba there. So that was something that was just starting to be developed and something that was then became quite popular. And now it's coming back with Roundup being used less, dicamba is starting to be used more.
Now, and I know some people that are concerned with dicamba. They say it's even more volatile. When you apply it, it gets up and moves and covers. And, in fact, I suppose that for organic farmers have to be concerned about how close they are to some of this chemical farming, as you've described it.
Well, that's right. And dicamba, it's worse than Roundup in that it moves as a cloud, sort of. and it can move miles that way. Roundup goes up in the air, evidently into the atmosphere, and is dispersed in very low quantities, but it goes everywhere. So that's its disadvantage, is it could travel maybe hundreds of miles. If it's coming down in the rain, we don't know where in the world those rain clouds were formed and how far that stuff has traveled.
Now, Bob, you have a company that's also marketing some of these wheat products, or some. Excuse me for kind of bumping into that, but you also market this wheat, right? That you're producing.
Well, I started out that way when I owned Montana Flour and Grain. I started in 1983, and in 1999, I sold it to some of my employees, and now they own it. So I'm not in the marketing directly anymore. But the ancient wheat that the project you're referring to is our ancient Kamut brand Khorasan wheat, and we do we don't market that directly because we license the marketers to the growers and the producers and the cleaners and distributors of it to, and any manufacturer that want to use a trademark, they are licensed to use a trademark and they do their own marketing. But we protect and promote the trademark, and we also spend a lot of money in research and comparing modern grain and ancient wheat with modern wheat.
Well, explain ancient to us. What does that mean?
Well, I've kind of made it up myself. It's really a definition. Sometimes it's a little elusive, but in my mind, ancient wheat is coming from ancient civilizations. So if you have an ancient civilization with its products, we call those ancient grains or ancient peas or whatever it is that they might have grown that could be identified from that time period. The other term that we throw around a lot are heirloom or heritage grains, and generally those are grains that were raised before World War II, at least, before the large breeding program started to change those a lot. And most of those grains and the ancient wheat that we're dealing with are really not pure lines, but land races, meaning that they're made up of several or many close related lines that primitive farmers would have collected from the wild by and large and just selected the best for their locale year after year, century after century, and that's how they were developed. But they were never intended to be absolutely pure because they wanted diversity in their crops, diversity that would allow some different diversity in seed in disease resistance, in insect resistance, and those sorts of things. And that's now we have with the climate, you know, what people call this climate change around now. I don't really call it that anymore. I call it climate chaos. I think that really more truly represents what's going on. It's just chaotic. But the more diversity you have in your cropping systems and within the crops you grow, the more resilience you're going to have against these cataclysmic events we have in our climate now. And that's what we found in our cropping system. And I think that is also something we can use to, it doesn't mediate climate chaos, but it protects us a little bit from it.
So when you market your wheat, and you've got some varieties, you've got the ancient wheat, where does it end up being consumed?
Well, with our Kamut Khorasan wheat, 85% of everything we plant in Montana, Alberta, and Saskatchewan goes to Europe, and 75% goes to Italy, and that's our biggest markets. And there's probably close to 3,000 different products all over the world, but 90% of those 3,000 are found in Italy.
Wow, why is that?
They really latched onto it. It's a grain that's very close relative of durum. So it's very easy to make a pasta out of it, and they're real great on, real big on pastas and that sort of thing, and that's what they do.
Is there any nutritional differences between those varieties?
Yes. Well, one thing we found right away is that people who said they couldn't eat modern wheat could eat our ancient wheat, and I was, my scientific background really made me curious to understand why that is the case, so we went to work in Italy. We couldn't find anybody in America 30 years ago who wanted to work with us or believe there was a problem with wheat. Now many more think there's a problem, but in those days they didn't. But in Italy, they were very interested to work with us, and we spent probably over $2 million in research over the last 10 years, and we've been able to study most of the, serious chronic diseases, of like heart disease, diabetes, irritable bowel syndrome, non-alcoholic fatty liver syndrome, because we discovered that this grain was anti-inflammatory, and inflammation is connected with all chronic disease. So we started studying chronic disease using human volunteers in clinical trials, and we published now over 31 peer-reviewed journal articles that you can go to our website and get direct connection to these articles and read it for yourself.
What website is that?
Kamut.com.
How do you spell that?
K-A-M-U-T. K-A-M-U-T.
So if we are not in Italy, sadly, and we were looking for finding some of that product here in the States, how could we do it? Where would we find that product?
Any health food store of any size at all throughout all of America will be carrying several brands that feature Kamut brand grain and cereal. Bob's Red Mill is spread all over the country, and they will carry grain and flour and a porridge. Nature's Path is one of the leading organic cereal companies in the world, actually, but they're a Canadian company, but selling a lot in America, and their heritage grain is mostly Kamut brand wheat, and they have other Kamut brand wheat cereals and contain that. Eden Foods has a Kamut brand pasta, and they're distributed all over. You can find them in most any health food stores. And then many other smaller companies doing bread. Plainland Mills in California does couscous and bulgur. So you can find some of those you can't find in every health food store, but if you ask for the brand names, for if they're carrying other products with that brand name, they can certainly get it for you.
Well, I was struck by when you started this whole conversation, you were saying when you got going into organic, it was really from consumer demand that you had people that were wanting to find organic wheat.
That's right. I wouldn't have started if someone didn't ask me to grow it, because I wasn't I wasn't converted, it wasn't a social conversion for me or a moral conversion. Like some of my friends have expressed to me, that's why they converted. They thought that putting poisons on the ground was immoral. I wasn't raised that way. I thought spraying and using all these chemicals was perfectly natural, and it was because that's all I knew. It didn't strike me that it was really a recent change in agriculture, but once I started into it and started to study it and started to understand it, and started to see the results, that's when I was converted, and now I've become a very enthusiastic supporter of organic all over the world. I travel all over the world and speak at different events and help organic farmers wherever they ask me, essentially, to come and help them. I just returned from Mongolia a month or so ago, because they wanted to change their wheat to organic production in Mongolia. The government policy is to support organic and conversion to organic. That's way different than we have in America. It was really a thrill to be there and be in that kind of an atmosphere after fighting here for so many years against the chemical industrial complex and all of their influence in Washington and every state. So it was like a breath of fresh air. And this is what we often refer to as a third world country, and yet they are more visionary than we are. It's amazing.
Well, I know that you have speaking engagements going up in this country, too, and I know you've got something coming up, an eco farm, and there will be lots of people there, and you're going to do one of the keynotes there, and I'm sure you're speaking at some other areas around the country as well. What do you hope?
Well, I knew that our chance to visit, like with you, Roger, is only a limited amount of time, so I decided to write a book. And so most of my speaking the last 10 months and the next 2 months is my 12-month book tour that I'm on.
Great.
I wrote the book Grain by Grain, and it's available at all your local bookstores and Barnes & Noble and even online if you want to do that. And that's what I've been speaking on pretty intensely here since March. It came out in March.
So you're producing wheat, and the people are enjoying your wheat from all over the country and in Italy, and people can be looking for the ancient grains and so forth. And you also are speaking and writing a book. When you are speaking or when people read your book, what's the one thing you hope you accomplish from having done that?
I hope they'll think about what they eat, and I hope they'll think about what they buy that they're going to eat, because what you buy, you're really voting for the kind of agriculture you want. If you want to be poison-free, then buy organic. And if you want to increase your health, then eat organic. And it's as simple as that. And what I'm trying to share with people is really the high cost of cheap food, and that food should be something that we'd be willing to invest in because it has a high value. And rather than just focusing on getting it as cheap as possible and not really caring about what it does to us other than fill our bellies, my message is that, you know, we're very well fed in this country, but we're not well nourished. And nourishment is connected to health. So if I can reconnect the idea of agriculture with food, with health, that would accomplish the goal that I had from my book.
Well, we're glad you're telling that story. There may even be a farmer or two out there that think they may want to follow in your steps.
That's exactly right. And if people would support us with their dollars, we will certainly grow it the way you want it grown. That's really the key. The pull-through is the 99% of us who aren't farmers, or the people who aren't farmers, but the 100% of us who are eaters, those are the people that determine what kind of agriculture we have in the end.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.